with a national award-winning program entitled, cleverly, Court with Class. Invitations are sent to high school, sometimes middle school students across the state. They are invited to attend an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the court sends materials about the case that they will hear. They may engage in other activities relating to this case. They then come to the court to listen to oral argument. And at noon, we'll meet with a justice of this court and discuss the procedures of the court and how the court takes the case and how the court decides the case. And today, the court member who will meet with the class is Justice Crooks. The discussion will not be about the substance or the substantive issue of the case, but about procedure, and everyone is welcome to attend. With that stated, is there anyone here who would like a summary of the case we're about to hear? Makes it easier to understand and listen if you're familiar with the issues. All right. Let me introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Sitting next to Justice Ziegler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left, Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case today, 07AP308, Kiwanda F. Luckett versus Aaron C. Bodner, M.D. We have a series of lawyers, and I'll make sure we are all on the same page on this. The first counsel will be Scott L. Howey, who is not licensed in Wisconsin, but will be introduced by attorney Lori J. McElroy. He will argue for 15 minutes. Stephen Sager will argue for 10 minutes. They will both be representing Dr. Bodner. For 30 minutes, Michael End will represent Luckett, the special administrator, and 5 minutes in rebuttal by Mr. Howey. Is that the agreed upon lineup? Okay. Mr. Howey.
Justice Abramson and members of the court, I'm Lori McElroy of the Action Banner and Weir firm, and I have previously moved to admit Scott Howey pro hoc vice, which was granted on December 8th of 2008, and we represent Aurora Sinai Medical Center and the Medical Protective Company. It's a great pleasure. I introduce Mr. Howey.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Howey, are you a member in good standing of what bar, Illinois?
I am, Your Honor.
You are admitted for purposes of this argument only.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, and thank you for the opportunity to appear pro hoc vice on behalf of my clients, Aurora Sinai and the Medical Protective Company. This appeal is not just about a statute or about a rule of civil procedure. This appeal concerns the question of trust and who ought to bear the burden when one party trusts in another's mistake. More specifically, of course, it does concern a statute, Section 80411, which provides for requests to admit, and specifically refers to three admissions made under that statute in the case of Tawanda Luckett, who is now deceased. She maintains in the merits of this case concern the question of whether the defendants were liable for the severe brain damage that she suffered in the year 2000.
Counsel, before you begin, and I will ask opposing counsel the same thing, When he moved to withdraw an admission, he moved to withdraw the admission to request to admit number two, which was the one that spoke of her being in a persistent vegetative state from the time she entered the long-term care facility. When the court granted the motion, it appeared to encompass both 1, 2, and 3 of the admissions. Now, in opposing counsel's brief, he said that he will stipulate that the admission should stand for 1 and 3. So I want to know, where are we? Are we just looking at admission 2? Or in your view, are we looking at all 3? And if so, given what counsel has said, given his initial motion to the court, just where are we so I can focus better?
As I understand the interplay between counsel's original oral motion and the eventual stipulations counsel has made in the context of this appeal, it appears that we are only looking at the second admission.
So you agree with that, and that's what we need to focus our attention on.
Appears, Mr. End, I don't know if Mr. End agrees with that, but that is my understanding of his stipulation and how it plays in.
And that's acceptable to you?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Certainly. Thank you.
This case does concern admissions made in the case of Tawanda Luckett.
Counsel, for some reason my recollection is that there was a request for withdrawal of all three admissions. So,
I believe there is some inconsistency in that. I think by the time that the withdrawals were being discussed before the trial judge, we were speaking in terms of all three admissions. To some extent, there is some overlap in the subject matter. But certainly at this point, given the plaintiff's offers to stipulate in his appellate briefs before this court, it appears that he is, if he did not previously withdraw the first and third admissions, he has subsequently given them back.
Well, counsel, that's critical for me. I need that issue resolved between the lawyers, because the one thing I'm going to look for both sides to explain to me is how... when you file a lawsuit in 2003 and the requests for admission are answered in 05 and the death occurs in 05, how some notes from 2001 bear upon your ability to properly prepare the case. And that is, if only two is the request to withdraw, then they're admitting she's presently in a persistent state, in 05. They're admitting that it's a permanent state, but that they're denying that she was in that persistent state when she was admitted to Silver Spring Health Rehabilitation Center, presumably for that pocket of time in April and June of 01. Which, how would you turn back the hands of time and have an expert tell you whether or not someone is in that state, especially when you don't even file the lawsuit till 03? So you need to reconcile for me both sides how that would be relevant and how you really would prevent how it's prejudicial to you either way. But if there's a dispute over the whole thing, that's a different story to me.
Well, rather than, I'm sorry, counsel, but let's just deviate from our usual practice. Rather than spend an hour not knowing what you agree on, what you don't agree on, why can't we just settle this out for a moment and just give him additional time? It is your opinion, I gather, that as to item two, there is a motion to withdraw that admission.
That's correct.
What does two say?
Two refers to the... plaintiff, or Ms. Luckett, at the time, the named plaintiff, being in a persistent vegetative state from the time of her admission to the Silver Spring Rehabilitation Center. That was September 29th of 2000. I don't believe the request contains the date, but we do know from the record.
So that she was, there's a dispute about her being in a vegetative state from September 2000 to what date?
To the present time, at the time
and
that
she
the
died.
Request was admitted. At the time the request was made and later admitted,
still
she was
alive.
Still alive.
Okay. All right.
And that fact is crucial to the prejudice that we maintain and suffer.
Mr. End, can you take the microphone, please, for a moment? Is there a motion to withdraw admissions 1 and 3? Do you agree that those motions to withdraw are now no longer pending?
Your Honor, in the trial court...
I want to know now.
Well, as I said in my brief, we're not making an argument that as of the date of the admission that she was in anything other than a persistent vegetative state. But at the time, we argued that, you know, that had not been known.
So, is the only admission that we're talking about number two or not?
Yes.
Number two is the only admission.
Yes.
That is the one you want to withdraw.
Yes.
You think she may not have been, or she wasn't in a vegetative state from September 2000 until her death, or just before her death.
That's correct.
All right. Does the court have any other questions about that? Go ahead, Justice Ziegler.
Thank you. Request to admit one is that she's presently in a persistent vegetative state. So that is from 05. So you agree as of 05 she was in that state, yes, sir?
That's what the admission
says. Do you see what I'm saying? It does.
It has to be in front of the microphone.
You know, I misspoke. I am sorry. I misspoke. What I, in my brief, said we're happy to stipulate to is that, well, yes, I did. As of July of 05, she was, in fact, in a persistent vegetative state. I did not know that at the time we had this hearing because I hadn't done this analysis that we have done. But I am now stipulating that as of that date, she was in a persistent vegetative state.
And that it was permanent. That's three.
Yes.
The thing that you've withdrawn is the request to admit number two, and that would be that she was in that state since she was admitted to Silver Spring Health Rehabilitation Center.
That is correct.
What's the date of that admission?
That was September 29, 2000.
Okay. So from September 29, 2000 until July 22nd or so of 05, you're saying there's some question as to whether she was in that permanent or in that state. But from 05 on to the date of her death, presumably, which was shortly after. Then,
what about before 2000, before September 29, 2000?
There was no stipulation, no request for admission,
okay.
So that's
right.
Open game.
All right, now let's see if we got this straight. That you are willing to admit, and that as of July 2005, she was in a persistent vegetative state, and that was permanent.
Yes.
That her condition from September 29, 2000 to July 22, 2005, you are not willing to admit that she was in a permanent vegetative state. You did make that admission, but you wanted it withdrawn. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Thank you, Mr. N. Mr. Howie, is that your understanding?
That is
just stated. Okay. All right. So we're talking about September 29, 2000 to July 22, 2005. Marshall?
It is also, in my understanding, that is something of a change in the plaintiff's position that has evolved over the course of this appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And it is only in this court those first and third admissions to the requests have formally been, in essence, given back.
Okay, but the trial court ruled on all three admissions.
That's correct.
All right.
Yes. We are now only talking about request number two.
Right.
That certainly is the heart of the argument because it is the one with the most impact and therefore the most prejudicial effect upon the defendants.
The most time.
The most time, sir. Section 804.11,
before you get into your argument, there's something else that I need to have clarified. And when I got done with the briefs, I just wasn't clear in this regard. After the judge granted the request to withdraw the admission, was there then an adjournment of the trial? Was the trial rescheduled?
Trial was later rescheduled.
How long was that adjournment or rescheduling?
I believe it was several months. I don't off the top of my head know exactly how long that was, but it was quite some time perhaps reflecting the fact that a good deal of discovery would then need to be done with respect to this issue of persistent vegetative
state. That's exactly why I'm asking the question, because I would anticipate there'd be a need for further discovery, and that certainly bears upon the issue of prejudice as well.
That's
so
correct.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Section 804.11 codifies the notion of trust between the parties and between the court as well. It enables the parties to define and limit the issues in controversy, and more importantly, to trust that certain issues and matters are not in controversy so that they may concentrate their attention and efforts on those that are. And while it permits a party to withdraw admissions in certain circumstances, that signal purpose, that purpose of trust behind 804.11, demands that those circumstances be judged by a very high standard. And the statute sets them forth. In its words, the court may permit withdrawal when the presentation of the merits of the action will be subserved thereby, and the party who obtained the admission fails to satisfy the court that withdrawal will prejudice the party in maintaining the action or defense on the merits. Those twin concerns dovetail in this case, and the trial judge's order satisfies neither of them. Deeming a substantial damages issue resolved, only to revive it a year and a half later in a vastly different evidentiary landscape, not only causes prejudice to the defendants, but for the same reason it causes them prejudice, it also frustrates the presentation of the merits. Either of those concerns alone should prevent the withdrawal of an admission, all the more so when they both appear, and especially when they act in concert, as they do in this case. Allowing the plaintiffs to withdraw their admissions in this case did not satisfy the requirements of Section 804.11, and the trial judge erred in allowing them to do so. That ruling, we maintain, should be reversed.
Well, counsel, we have a couple of issues, at least as I understand the case. One is, how do you interpret this statute, right, 804.11? Do you need both parts of the statute?
You do, Your Honor, and Mr. Sager is intending to address that in some more depth.
That's fine. We can do that. The next part, then, is prejudice. Is that what you're going with?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Go ahead and do that, but keep in mind that the trial court made very few findings about prejudice. It was a very limited exercise of his discretion. Some might say none.
Some might say that, and I think we agree with that.
Well, then, as you speak, would you please keep in mind, should this court exercise the discretion? Ordinarily, we don't. Or should this be sent back?
Certainly, Your Honor. The notion of prejudice, as many cases interpreting both 804.11 and the federal counterpart, Federal Rule 36, have defined prejudice as the difficulty a party may face in proving its case because of the sudden need to obtain evidence. Now, that's exactly what we have in this case. Because of the way in which the evidentiary environment changed during the year and a half that the admission, we're only talking about one now, was enforced. The dissenting judge in the Court of Appeals called this a perfect storm of prejudice and likened it to sending a fighter into the ring with both hands tethered.
Counselor, was it really important that the admission was not requested to be withdrawn for a year and a half when the woman died about, I don't know, 2 months or 6 weeks after the admissions were made? So even if he had said within the day after she died, and there's some dispute in the record about exactly when she died, but just say it's 6 weeks afterwards. Even if he had said on 6 weeks in one day, I want to withdraw these requests for admission, the type of prejudice you outline in your brief would have been just the same, wouldn't it?
Some of the prejudice would have been the same.
What would have been different?
The prejudice in any case would have been fading of memories, deterioration of evidence in general. That's not the focus of our argument, but it's certainly something that could be considered in this case. The year and a half added on to the already several years before the admissions were made is a period.
The converse of that question, I'd like you to answer as well. Say they would have denied it instead of admitting it. What would you have done differently? You had a month.
We would have examined Mrs. Luckett to determine not only whether she was in a persistent vegetative state, which was an issue at the time, but also potentially how long she had been in that state.
Why didn't you do it in the preceding 2 years? That's what I'm trying to get at. This remark is back from 01 in the medical record. You file in 03, you do the request for admissions in 05, 6 weeks later, after the answer, she dies. And you're saying that if they would have denied it, you would have jumped on that, gotten an expert immediately in there as she's on death's door, pretty much, and then decided to pursue that issue when you hadn't for a couple of years. That's what I was trying to get at the beginning. You've got to help me with that, because this is also from notes that are from before you, 2 years before you even filed the lawsuit.
One thing to bear in mind, and just as an aside, is that it's actually 10 weeks by the plaintiff's admission between the time the admission was made and the time that Ms. Luckett died. But besides that, and getting to the gist of your question, there was no indication at the time in the first 2 years of the case that there was a need to perform any such examination. Certainly as she approached her death, that would have been something that would have been far more significant to preserve evidence for trial to determine what her state was.
I don't understand your response, because I thought that you had the same papers that Mr. End had, and that the medical records showed, if they were read carefully, that during this time period she might not have been in a persistent vegetative state.
Well, there's some, to the extent that the records are relevant to the appeal and to the withdrawal of the admission, they are less than conclusive. To be charitable, there are statements made by two of Ms. Luckett's treating physicians, not by expert witnesses. They are equivocal in the extreme. One of them even states that it's hard to tell.
So you were on alert. You knew this all the time, that she might have been, she might not have been.
Certainly an examination might have been done earlier. The fact that it was not doesn't have a bearing on the question of the prejudice to the defendants. The fact is they were entitled to rely upon the admissions given, and did in fact rely on them. And that reliance, frustrated when the withdrawal was made, is the basis for reversal, the basis for prejudice, one of the two prongs under 804.11.
Counselor, is there anything in the record that shows that if someone had examined her after you made your request for admissions, that they would have been able to determine what her circumstances were like in September of 2000, 5 years earlier?
There's nothing conclusive, but part of the reason for that is one of the other elements of our prejudice, and that is the fact that the expert we had retained to examine not just Ms. Luckett herself, but the entire issue of persistent vegetative state, had himself died during this year and a half.
Well, there's got to be more than one doctor that knows about persistent vegetative states, Counselor.
I'm sure that there are, but the one we had, we were very confident in and believed in. And losing that expert is another element of prejudice.
I appreciate that. It's a good point. What concerns me more, though, is if he had denied it and you examined her in July of 2005, it seems to me if you're going to show that your proof was harmed, you would have had to put some kind of offer of proof in the record to show that he would have known what her state was like in 2000 by that 2005 examination. And I'm not a doctor, but boy, I never have heard that you could tell when something like that starts if it's in existence 5 years later.
My time has expired.
Please help me. I'm interested in your answer, obviously.
Part of the reason that that's not part of the record and why we don't know is a further demonstration of the prejudice that the defendants have suffered. It's not just that we don't know what the expert might have been able to determine. But the reason we don't know that is because of the admission and because more thorough and more extensive discovery was not conducted into the issue of persistent vegetative state. The expert who subsequently died was, in fact, affirmatively told that his services would no longer be required. He was told to stand down because this was an issue that had been resolved. And that is reliance upon, as an example of reliance upon an admission, a justifiable reliance that the defendants placed in the belief and the trust that persistent vegetative state would not be an issue at trial. That the question of the decedent's or of Ms. Luckett's conscious pain and suffering would not be an issue for most of the period of time that was at issue.
So then if I understand your position, you didn't feel any obligation in your burden to show prejudice that if the doctor, a doctor, your doctor, some doctor, had examined her before she died, they would have been able to tell what her condition was back in 2000, 5 years earlier.
Well, there was, keep in mind that we had three admissions at issue at the time, and one of which was present in persistent vegetative state. So it was relevant to that, now no longer an issue because of the plaintiff's stipulation. To the extent that there might have been the ability to determine persistent vegetative state in the past, that was an issue that I don't think it was possible to show, to make that sort of showing at the trial court level at the time that the admission was withdrawn. But the reason for that inability to show is, again, traceable directly back to the admission.
Is it traceable to the admission, or is it traceable to what medicine can or cannot do? I guess what's troubling me is that I didn't find anything in the record where a medical doctor said, if I had examined her on this date, I might have been able to show when the persistent vegetative state began because of A, B, and C, D, E, and F. I mean, there have got to be criteria that physicians look at that aren't particular to this particular person.
Well, it's important to recognize, too, that the this entire issue played out over a very short period of time. It was, and not just a short period of time, but in the waning days, the 11th hour before trial was to take place. So the entire process was considerably shortened. The expert who we ordinarily would have consulted to make that determination had not only been called off several months before, but also had died in the meantime.
When was he called off, and when did he pass away?
I don't believe the record reflects when he was called off. But
was it before the request for admissions?
No, it was after. And it was because of the, it was not only before the, not only after the request, but after the admissions themselves were made. And he was called off specifically because the admission had been made, and the issue to which he would have testified, persistent vegetative state, was no longer part of the case anymore because of the admission made by the plaintiff.
And you believe that he would be able to, other than through a paper review, meet with her who's in a persistent vegetative state and opine that in 2000, 2001, 2003, 4, and 5, she was still in that state? It's a similar question, but...
We believe that at some point during that period of time, that expert would have been able to determine at some within some range of that period of time, perhaps all of it, but certainly some of it, would have been able to determine if she was currently in a persistent vegetative state, might also have been able to determine how long that state had been in existence. And
by paper review or by meeting her and testing her?
Likely both. Likely both. But certainly the ability to examine her in person would have played a role in that. Certainly would have been directly relevant to the issue of present persistent vegetative state.
They admit that, though.
Which they now admit and did not at the time, but that is an evolution of the plaintiff's position over time.
Justice Brasa, do you have a question?
I sure do.
I can see it coming.
Could we go over the facts? The deceased was injured in Sinai Samaritan Medical Center, is that right?
Yes.
That was in August of 2000?
That's correct.
And subsequent things happened, and she was transferred to a rehabilitation center?
Yes.
September 29th?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so we're talking about what her condition was from September 29th, 2000, until July 22nd, 2005. And all that time, she was at the rehabilitation center.
That's correct.
Where were the records that Mr. End found these statements?
I believe they were in his office. I don't believe there's any dispute that those records were in his possession.
I mean, where did he get them from?
What facility?
What facility did he get them from?
Presumably those are, at least some of those records are from Silver Spring, the rehabilitation center. I'm not sure the record reflects where all of them come from.
For example, would Sinai Samaritan have had those records in their files?
I don't know. The record doesn't reflect that those were in the possession of the defendants as well. I suspect some of them likely were, because some of the defendants were relevant to that treatment. But for the most part, if these were Silver Spring records, they would have presumably been maintained by Silver Spring, and would have been because they were the plaintiff's records, they would have been in the possession of the plaintiff's counsel. Because the transfer of Ms. Luckett from the hospital to the rehabilitation center occurred in 2000, presumably records from 2001, which describes the records the plaintiff's counsel claims to have found in 2007, would not have been in the possession of the defendants themselves, certainly not in the possession of the defendants whose only involvement in Ms. Luckett's care was prior to her transfer to Silver Spring.
I'd like to ask this. Do you have this appendix here, the complaint that was...
Is this the appendix of the doctor?
Yes.
Okay. It's your appendix.
It's Exhibit 3.
The plaintiff's complaint, counsel, Justice Prosser?
I'm looking at paragraph 14 of the complaint. And on page 5 of the complaint.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm with you.
At the top of the page, Ms. Luckett was then admitted to the intensive care unit where she suffered an arrest. As a result, Ms. Luckett suffered severe hypoxic, and then I'm going to have trouble with that word.
Encephalopathy.
Thank you, sir. What does that mean?
I believe that's a fancy medical term for severe brain damage, which is the far more pronounceable term that most of us have been using in the context of this case.
So how did the defendants plead to that allegation?
I beg your pardon?
How did the defendants plead to paragraph 14?
I believe the defendants have denied that all the material... I take that back. To the extent that that allegation states that she suffered severe brain damage, certainly the defendants deny liability for her brain damage. I don't know that they deny that it in fact happened. They certainly deny legal liability for it.
Has there been a trial on liability?
There's not.
Okay. So we're pre-trial.
For the moment, I think we can presume that it is in fact true.
The allegation is medical malpractice. The allegation is damage to the brain.
Correct.
Okay. You deny the malpractice, I assume.
Correct.
There was damage to the brain, so you don't deny that.
Correct.
It's just you didn't cause it. Your client didn't cause it.
Correct.
All right. And so this case involves pre-trial admissions.
That's correct. And the significance of the particular pretrial admission that we're still talking about now is the effect on damages, specifically
sure.
on pain and
suffering. Because if you're found liable, and if she's in persistent vegetative state and feels no pain, the damages would be less. Right?
That's correct.
If she feels pain, then the damages are more.
That's correct.
And so it was to your interest to have her in a persistent vegetative state.
That's correct. And that was the issue that we believed, justifiably believed, had been resolved against the notion of pain and suffering for that period of time because of the admission.
Justice Prosser?
I'm substantially over my allotted
time.
I know.
It's the
It's not your choice, counsel. It's court's choice.
No,
Justice Strasser.
I guess what I'm suggesting is the plaintiff alleges severe hypoxic, and you pronounced it,
encephalopathy.
And then the plaintiff admitted a persistent vegetative state from the time of that they left the hospital and went to Silver Spring.
That's correct.
And then they withdrew that admission. So, I mean, I think, doesn't that go to really the urgency for you to look at these records?
I'm not sure that I understand Your Honor's question. I don't know if this answers your question, but it may be a question of whether severe hypoxic encephalopathy is the same thing as a persistent vegetative state, and I believe that it is not. In other words, she may have suffered severe brain damage and yet not have been in a persistent vegetative state. So the allegation that she suffered this particular injury is not the same thing as an admission that she was in a persistent vegetative state. I'm not sure if that addresses the gist of Your Honor's question.
Okay. Do they ever overlap?
I imagine that they do. I think this is the injury, but it may lead to, another fancy medical term is sequelae. In other words, further damages or injuries resulting from the original injury. But the state of being in a persistent vegetative state and therefore unable to experience pain and suffering consciously is not necessarily the same thing as suffering brain damage. It would be the same, for instance, it's not an uncommon injury in many medical malpractice cases for a plaintiff to suffer a brain injury and suffer brain damage and yet still be conscious, perhaps functioning to a certain level, and most importantly, able to experience the consequences of that injury.
I don't know if this is what Justice Prosser is concerned about, but the complaint was filed in 2003, right?
That's correct.
When was the admissions made? When did you request admissions, or didn't you?
The requests were made in June of 2005. They were admitted, affirmatively admitted, by a response admitting them the following month, exactly 30 days later.
Why didn't you, you've got a potentially huge claim against you here. So why between 2003 and 2005, before any admissions, didn't you examine this victim? I don't know if that's what you're driving at, Justice Prosser. It's a good point. That's what I've been driving at. All right, I'm sorry, I missed it with you, Justice Prosser.
I think that's a fair question on the facts.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is
it on the record? Is your response on the record?
I beg your pardon?
Is your response in the record?
I don't believe the record reflects that. I think what I can say is it appears simply not to have been a priority, and it seems to have been something that there was no urgency to determine because there was no recognition that it needed to be resolved soon. That changed as the plaintiff's death, or as Ms. Luckett's, pardon me, as her death approached, and once we had the admission in hand, there was no longer any need to do any investigation in that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period of time when it seemed not to be urgent, followed by a period of time when it actually would have been an irrelevant subject to examine.
I have a last question. You have told us a lot about the prejudice and given us a lot of material, but my sense is that a lot of this is not in the trial record and that the trial court judge did not ask you some of the questions we're asking you and that it's not in the record. Your responses are not in the record. I'm not being critical of you. I am just making a point. Is my point well taken?
It is certainly well taken, and it is
certainly true that
the trial judge did not ask nearly as many questions as this court has asked.
Well, that's why my question to you is, your brief asks that we reverse, if I understand your brief, you reverse the decision of the trial court, that we do, that this court not allow the plaintiffs to withdraw their admissions, and then it goes back for trial with these admissions, or whatever it happens, right?
Correct.
Well, and I could, that was my initial question to you. How can we do that when the trial court here never exercised its discretion, and we don't have a record other than what you're telling us here about the prejudice? Seems to me it has to go back, if we agree with you, it has to go back to the trial court. And you put in your evidence of prejudice there.
Two reasons, Your Honor.
Okay.
One is that I believe this court is in a position to determine as a matter of law that the death of the party who could have been examined would be sufficient prejudice. But even if that's not enough for the court, there is still the second element of the statute. Actually, it's the first element, and we're addressing it second, the question of whether the presentation of the merits would be subserved by the withdrawal.
All right. That is a perfect segue to your co-counsel.
It is a perfect segue. I recognize that I'm substantially over my time. I would hope to have a minute or two to address the question of presentation of the
merits. You will have that 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Start it with that, if you would. Okay? Thank you. I appreciate
you.
That, Mr. Howard. Mr. Sager. You're going to handle the first issue.
Well, I am, but I'm here to also answer some questions of the court, because
okay.
I was there from the beginning, and I can fill in a lot of the blanks that you've asked, but you're right on the money. The bottom line is that the court really did not, and it was pressed for time. We're at a pretrial on January 19th. We've got a trial on February 5th. The court did its best, I think, in making its assessment of what was prejudicial, what the merits needed, and he gave a shot at it the same day he issued his decision. So, anyway.
That gets to one of my concerns, and I've been rereading the transcript here. We are here on the order that incorporates the January 19th 2007, is it, letter of the judge?
That's correct.
And the stuff that I'm hearing, I don't see in the transcript.
That's a very good point as well.
And from the get-go, I thought to myself, well, maybe they went in and asked the judge to reconsider and make those arguments. I mean, this is how I see it, but tell me where I'm wrong. You have this hearing, I don't think you talked about the death of the client.
Oh, it was mentioned, it surely
mentioned.
Was.
I didn't
sure.
see it, okay. But I'll have to reread it, I didn't see that.
It was clearly part of it. The court knew that if it wasn't particularly addressed in the judge's decision. In the
well, it wasn't addressed in his yeah. decision.
Right.
But I didn't even
in the transcript
I get a quick read of the transcript.
Sorry. Go ahead.
The court asked if any additional arguments, people wanted to make any additional arguments, and no one wanted to, in terms of a briefing, is that right?
We were, in the words of counsel, the answer is yes, between a rock and a hard spot. We had a trial coming up, experts coming, witnesses yeah. there, and we just... He said, do you want any more? And we said, you know, no, I don't. There wasn't any request for more time, but it wouldn't have made any difference under the circumstances.
If you have additional arguments now to make regarding prejudice that you think weren't not considered, why didn't you bring Monday morning quarterback, but why didn't you bring a motion for reconsideration so that those questions that we are now asking here aren't, the court didn't have an opportunity to consider and weigh those things in the prejudice equation?
I think I can answer that real quickly.
Okay.
The judge said, I find prejudice.
Yeah.
All right. That to us and to the defendants meant that the two prongs were satisfied and he should have withdrawn refused to withdraw the request. He found prejudice. His decision says that he finds prejudice. But then he goes on, and that's part of what I was discussing, he goes on to balance between, well, fairness, I ought to let the plaintiff try their case, but I find prejudice. We think it should have stopped right there. So that's why we didn't revisit any more than was necessary. He found there was prejudice, but yet felt that he had an obligation to do this balancing. And I've read every case that's been cited, believe me, every one of them. And there isn't one case, Federal Rule 36, or Wisconsin construction of Federal Rule 36, or our 801, 804, 11-2, none of them say that you need to do more than find prejudice. They find, if you find prejudice, you stop there. And then he went on to balance. And I understand where he was coming from. He was trying to be fair and equitable. He quotes that in his decision. But that's not what the law says.
Well, prejudice, I suppose, is on a sliding scale, isn't it?
No.
He well, either finds pre-
he, well, I'm sorry, you're right.
I would think that in most instances, every time a judge would grant an adjournment, allows the withdrawal and grants an adjournment, which is what I would expect. Not necessarily, if he's going to, in this kind of a case, if he's going to allow withdrawal, I would expect him to grant an adjournment. That's right, you did. But I think that the granting of an adjournment is per se prejudicial. Per se, I can count the ways just granting a continuance is going to mean more cost to the client. It's going to mean that the docs have to reschedule. It's going to mean, as in any case, additional time, which might mean faded witnesses. It's going to mean that you're going to have to, as an attorney, clear your calendar. You have this, and the judge was very concerned about his calendar. You know, this trial's going on until it wasn't going on. There's all sorts of prejudice, but just because there's prejudice, because now I might not be able to bill, get the additional files on certain days as an attorney, and lose a little bit of money, is that enough prejudice? Is any kind of prejudice enough prejudice?
The case law says it is. That's one of the major factors. But I want to add to that, and that's right. I think it is.
I'm going to have to get a babysitter now.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to get a babysitter. Is that prejudice?
Your Honor is right. The court has to find what's significant prejudice and what is not. And that's what he found. He found in his case, he said, these resultant adjournment and additional discovery is sufficient to establish prejudice and to justify the denial of the request. But then he goes on in his final page to say, well, I'm going to balance these two prongs, and that's where we feel the error is. But can I add just one thing to what you said? This all would be academic if, in fact, in October, if she hadn't died in October 2nd, by the way, that's the date, if that had gone on and Mr. N had come back with a request for a withdrawal at that time, this would all be very academic, because under those circumstances, it makes some sense to say, well, we can schedule this trial and deal with it. Right now, we're on hold, as I believe Justice Ruggins, Justice Crooks asked. We had a trial scheduled in June of that year, pending what would happen with the appeal. Once the appeal got granted, we got on a scheduling conference. And he said, let us know when we're done. So we're still not done, and we're still in that point. But I think the prejudice is, this is what the statute is supposed to do. The statute is supposed to plainly and simply allow a focus of issues. This was an issue, and I can honestly say this, that nobody thought was there until January 19th of 2007.
When did you get the copy? Some of the stuff indicates that defense counsel also had copies of the medical records.
We always do. I'm sure we have.
So when did you have those?
I have no specific recall, but I'm sure they were there by the time we requested the admissions. I have no idea. I'm sure they were.
My guess is you had them even earlier, because if you've got to decide if you're going to line up an expert witness,
exactly.
I mean, it's just kind of pro forma. You'll get the medical records shortly after the complaint is filed,
sure.
And you give it an answer.
Absolutely. We had those. I don't doubt that they were there. But then what we do with them is we send them to experts for review. And Dr. Cranford, by the way, was the physician who dealt with Terry Scheibel. We had a world-renowned expert that was going to look at this and assured us, based on his review, that he did not think that there was any issue that she had conscious pain and suffering at any time. And he was going to do an exam to do that. Once the admission was done, we saved an issue in the case. That's all that this was about. And everybody, Mr. N, too, were operating under that assumption for 4 years since the complaint was filed. Nobody thought that. There wasn't one question asked in the 26 depositions about whether or not she had conscious pain and suffering. None. Nobody questioned it because we didn't think it was an issue. Now, I still don't know if it's an issue. There's a little incorrect statement. The records that Mr. N referred to are from Frederick Hospital. I believe she went there from time to time for consultant care. And the others were at the Silver Spring. So she went two places. But those were in 2001, and those are very casual comments. Somebody said, why didn't we come with an affidavit or more information about that? About the plaintiff. Why didn't he come with an affidavit on that day saying, or as soon as possible after that, saying, I have an affidavit, Your Honor, that I have experts that will look at this and will interpret these records to tell you what this means.
Counsel, the problem is that you have the burden of proof under the statute according to the way I read it. So that's why I thought that the defendants ought to show their prejudice by something the defendants would put in.
We do, and that's the prejudice. The prejudice is we can't have what we need. In medical negligence cases, which is almost all that I do, is we try to get physicians who can use their expertise to help us to go back, and they can. They have amazing ways to look at of current states with people and to look at records and say, this person was like this from this time, or this person wasn't. And our information was that this person was always in a persistent vegetative state and never had any conscious pain and suffering.
But do they need the person physically present to do that?
Yes, you can't. It's similar to having a live witness versus a person by video. We needed that evaluation by the doctor to do that, to come up with a true and concrete opinion to convince or to sustain our response, and the burden of proof is on us to show the prejudice. That's true, but it isn't at trial. At trial, we have a response, but we never take those things lightly, and we always go aggressively and say, we will prove that this did not happen if you're saying it did. But we never had the if you're saying it did to respond to, so we are now left with an absolute inability to come up with good evidence other than a paper record review, which is just never as good as doing a old word, IME. Hypoxia, by the way, means deprivation of oxygen.
Yeah, but you know, the burden of proof is on the plaintiff to show damages at trial, and the plaintiff is standing in the same shoes you are under the trial court's decision, in that he's going to have an expert say, based on this paper record, she was in a persistent vegetative state from some point, or she never was. This shows that, in fact, she did have some awareness in 2001. Well, certainly on cross-examination, one would think the question would come up, well, did she have it in 2002? Is there anything that you know about that shows that, I mean, the burden of proof is on the plaintiff when you get to trial. It seems to me he's got the same problem you have.
He does, but he doesn't have the problem that we have, which is we have the ability to, would have had the ability to have her examined if we knew that was an issue. And we didn't have that opportunity. It's gone. Never will happen. And we can't get an instruction from the court during the argument to the jury and say, by the way, there were admissions that were withdrawn, and the defense would have had the opportunity to do an exam, and they would have likely have done that, and that would have helped them more, or that would have helped them explain to you more than just a paper record. We can't get an instruction like that. We're stuck. We have nowhere to go. There's no place to go. That is the key part, is she's not here. Poor lady is gone. Everybody's sad about that. But that's not the issue. The issue is how do we present a good defense to a claim? As the court probably knows, you've seen lots of malpractice cases up on appeal. Experts provide opinions on all kinds of things. Mr. End already, I think the record shows, he's already got experts that are going to support his claim. And I'm sure we can find some that will refute it. That's not the question. That's part of what we do. And there are good people out there, like you said, that can give all kinds of opinions in all kinds of ways. But it just isn't right the way this has come down. It just puts us in a hamstring position to be able to effectively represent our clients. And to nobody's discredit, nobody thought this was an issue.
2nd, right? 2005?
According to what we hear now, yes. So it was admitted.
But
acknowledged, excuse me.
might not have been in, I think it's June 2001?
We think she probably was from the moment she had her hypoxic injury at the August 27th when she suffered her arrest in Sinai Hospital.
You think she probably was?
And everybody else assumed that.
Hypothetically, suppose in June of 2001 she wasn't. When? How do you prove when she was?
And when she stopped being? That's another good question. How do we ever do that? I mean, let's assume that there is, it's just like the court's aware of the rules with regard to momentary periods of competence where a person can execute a document and sign a will and things like that. There could have been, on that day that Mr. End had quoted, on that day she could have had conscious pain and suffering, and on the very next day she could not have. We're in a merry-go-round or a roller coaster trying to find out the answers to those questions. And again, an examination of her personally would have helped immensely. And certainly the plaintiff had the opportunity to do that. If they have a person, an older person whose life expectancy is in doubt, what do? They often take a videotape. So they could have had the same evaluation or examination that we did if they chose that that was an issue, or if they felt that that was an issue in the case too. That would have been a proactive thing to do
Are you saying that Mr. N didn't have a doctor go there?
I don't think so. I think the only time that I believe he had an expert examine her for life expectancy, that isn't in the record, but he made a mistake, shall we say. That's all that I know. We weren't advised of any of that, and I don't know that he would have had an obligation to tell us, but I don't believe that that occurs. That's not in the record anywhere, that he had had that question evaluated. And that's that.
Are there any other questions? Hearing none.
I have to tell you, this is the second time I've been here. The first time I typed my bar exam here in 1968. It's a welcome pleasure. And none of you, the only reason they sent the six of us in here is because there were plugs in here and we could type.
Those were different days. Now they type them into computers.
Yes, I think that's why I passed. They were able to read it, and I got probably three extra points, which is probably put me over at the top.
Okay, counsel. Welcome home. Let me just check. Who's working with these students? Who's in charge of Port Washington High School students? What time do you have to leave? Okay. Right. Partially for the students, but also in light of the court, you have a half hour. The other side gets 5 minutes. That's 35 minutes, and we've got another case coming in at 1:30. So although this is not an ideal setup, and we try and avoid it, I'm going to, if it's okay with counsel and you can return, I would like counsel to return at 1:30. And Mr. End, you will be up. That gives you a half hour. That gives you an hour to eat and to rethink everything. The same thing for other counsel. If the marshal will advise the next case that there'll be a slight delay of approximately 35 minutes, that would be good. So we will take a recess. If Justice Crooks is in charge and will come out and get you out by 1 or whatever time you have to leave. Is that all right? All right. That's what we're going to do. We are in recess.
Here or no?